privacy has shifted from a conversation about whether you have control over your personal information to how you can be controlled by other people that have your personal information. That is a deep, deep shift, and that is precisely, I think, what we're dealing with right now.
After a year of privacy scandals, many consumers are beginning to realize that when it comes to their personal data, they aren't getting the trade they thought they were. We're wising up to the volume of data tech companies collect on us and realizing it exceeds what we could have imagined. Radio and podcast host Molly Wood of Marketplace Tech has been helping listeners untangle the complex web of the data economy on her show. She visited Seattle last week to discuss those issues with Giri Srinivas, CEO of private email server startup Helm, Ryan Kahlo, co-director of the University of Washington Tech Policy Lab, and me, Monica Nicholsberg, GeekWire's civic editor, during an event hosted by KUOW on March 14th. We'll start with Molly Wood's remarks, setting the stage for our discussion about the data economy.
Thanks, Karen. I have about a 7-minute presentation just sort of setting up the overarching themes of our conversation tonight about the data economy. And we're going to bring our panelists one at a time, late night talk show style, talk to them for 10 minutes or so about what they're doing, and then have a group discussion followed by a question and answer with all of you. It's going to be fascinating. Our panelists are brilliant, and I'm super excited to talk about this topic because it is the topic that never stops giving. Privacy. On my show, Marketplace Tech, our tagline is that we're trying to demystify the digital economy, and that means helping people understand this business model. And I feel like we are at a time when everyone is collectively starting to realize the business model of the web and the impact that it has on all of our lives. So in tonight's conversation, we're going to talk about these trade-offs that are part of the data economy. And the big trade-off really is the bargain that you thought you were making, which was, I will trade some of my personal information and I'll get a free service out of it. And that was a pretty straightforward bargain. Versus the bargain that you really made, which was, I will turn over all of my personal information, not just to one company, but to a company that might monetize it by handing it over or selling it to multiple other companies. And that I will be trading way more information than I thought I was. I think that's the realization a lot of us have come to. And so our question is, simply put, is this a fair trade? And it's a super appropriate time to have this conversation because we're coming up on what is basically the 1-year anniversary of Cambridge Analytica and that realization. So let's go back in time a little bit to a moment when I think we learned a lot about the business model of the services that we use every day. Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg, he had a very revealing exchange last April when he appeared on Capitol Hill.
How do you sustain a business model in which users don't pay for your service?
Senator, we run ads.
I see.
That was Senator Orrin Hatch asking, I mean, we're chuckling, Twitter was chuckling. But let's be honest, do you feel like you really understand how Facebook makes money? Because a lot of people don't. And so after that exchange, I got this tweet from a friend of mine who's a very accomplished tech reporter and said he was staggered by the lack of understanding of the business model. And frankly, I thought that moment was a win for Senator Orrin Hatch because it was the first time that Mark Zuckerberg did not say, we connect people, we create communities, we make it easier for you to talk to your friends, you know, we organize the world's information like Google would have said. He said, we run ads. And that was a really revealing moment for a lot of people because that's the moment when we started to realize that what they meant by that was we target ads for stuff you think you might want. We're the reason that the same ad is following you all over the internet. We will do anything to get more information about you so that we can target these ads. And that could include paying teenagers to download research apps that record everything they do. It could mean grabbing information about your friends and your friends of your friends, getting information from your cell phone carrier, buying information from third-party data brokers, your credit card company, the stores you shop at, the pet food place. Facebook will literally, like these companies were saying, we will literally manipulate your feelings as a research experiment to get more information to use to target ads to you. And we have promised other companies and political campaigns that our targeting is so good that it can actually affect your behavior. And so even though we all chuckled at this moment, I think it's the moment when we all realize that we're living in what I like to call the data economy. And I got a new slide. It was like magic. You, I'm sure, have heard this term, the data is the new oil. And that is what is making all of this run. And there have been a couple moments in the past few years when we realized, I think, the import of that. The Equifax hack was a moment. And then, of course, as you're going to hear in this next clip, the 2016 election and the Cambridge Analytica revelations were a huge turning point.
It's like the data equivalent of Fukushima. And when you think about something like Fukushima or Cambridge Analytica, it's a big hot point, and we take notice. I mean, everybody notices that this is going on. But like, if you take a nuclear disaster, it isn't just about that hot point. It's about a bigger question of how we produce energy and just the whole economy. I think we know we're making data every day, maybe. We probably don't think about it much, but we definitely don't step back to look at that bigger picture of the data-driven advertising economy.
So there are a whole bunch of factors that led us to step back and look at that whole advertising economy, which is part of what we're doing tonight. And look, I have to be honest, there were plenty of people also after the Cambridge Analytica hack who said, and in fact, I know a woman who's a small business owner and who said to me, I should probably be advertising on Facebook. Seems like this stuff really works. That is a reality of this conversation too, that I hope we're gonna have. But now we're trying to grapple with this new reality, and here's the thing, it's only gonna get worse. Like way worse. You had to know artificial intelligence was coming. You don't get a bunch of geeks on stage and not talk about AI at this point. Everyone is trying to develop or sell an artificial intelligence or machine learning solution. And all that is using huge amounts of data to draw conclusions and or make predictions faster and better and more efficiently than a human can do it. And a lot of these conclusions are great. Right? It might be language translation or medical diagnosis or real-time mapping and traffic rerouting or logistics and supply chain analytics or plagiarism detection. But it all relies on huge amounts of data. The real-time traffic information comes from millions of smartphones sending real-time location information to the mothership all day, every day. You have companies now who are bemoaning the problem of what they call dark data. This is just the stuff they don't know about you yet, and it drives them crazy. Because you can't have computers making really great predictions unless you have all of the information. And so as these technologies become a bigger and bigger part of their lives, and they will, then that raises this new question. What's next? And people are starting to, and that's what we're going to talk about tonight, it's also a question that people are starting to answer in some different interesting ways, including, should I be getting paid for this data? Which you could argue is kind of a radical idea, but maybe it's the time to think about it.
Well, you know, everybody is worried about AIs coming to displace their jobs and to take away their employment opportunities. And yet, if you work at one of these tech companies, like I do at Microsoft, you know that what makes machine learning systems that are supposed to replace your jobs in the future work is all of the data that individual people supply. You have these giant companies producing these amazing digital services and entirely forgetting about all the people who contributed the value to make them possible.
So Glenn Weil co-wrote a book called Radical Markets, Uprooting Capitalism and Democracy for a Just Society. And one of the entire chunks of that book is about the idea that we are all working as unpaid data laborers. And when I talked to Glenn, maybe a year ago, 8 months ago, that was a really radical idea. It was a fun thought experiment. You know, he suggested that, you know, let's say if I know, when it comes to training AI systems, if I know Farsi, that's a high value skill. Maybe I could get paid a little more for that. Or if my son will not stop playing Fortnite, and he will not, I'm failing, that he could potentially also be cracking codes while he's playing Fortnite. He could be putting those skills to use, and that might actually give him some value and also be awesome for me. He could contribute to the rent for once. But it does come back to this idea that we are starting to consider radical solutions, that we're starting to consider how to come at this question of the bargain. And we are seeing people put forward solutions. This is why the GDPR in Europe, their big general data privacy regulations have come to pass. That's why California is passing data privacy laws. Senator Amy Klobuchar, in her presidential run, talked about data privacy. The governor of California just suggested that perhaps our state should actually pay people a data dividend, like the people who live in Alaska get an oil dividend. These are becoming much more serious conversations as we are talking about size and power. The FTC is holding new hearings to discuss whether our existing antitrust regulations and frameworks are enough to deal with companies that feel like a monopoly, except that they're kind of in everything. I mean, Amazon. It's not an obvious one, but it feels like it should be. There are hearings on social media and influence. You have Elizabeth Warren proposing to break up the biggest tech companies. All of this really is just about trying to grapple with these influences that feel totally out of our control. So it's no surprise that radical thinking is a part of that conversation.
That's Molly Wood of American Public Media's Marketplace Tech Report, speaking at an event in Seattle on March 14th. When we come back, we'll hear from our panel.
Technology moves fast. I need to move faster. WGU's competency-based education puts me in control of how fast I move through my IT degree program. I can accelerate my program by applying what I already know to my courses and focusing on the things I need to learn. Earn a respected accredited degree that propels your career in the IT field. Learn more at wgu.edu/IT Certs Included.
Welcome back to the GeekWire podcast. On this episode, we're featuring highlights from a recent discussion about the data economy, moderated by Molly Wood. Let's jump into the panel discussion.
Let's start to dig into this with our panelists. Like I said, they'll come up one at a time and tell us what they're working on. We'll take some questions from the audience. And first up, Monica Nicholsberg, who you probably all know from GeekWire, civic innovation editor covering how tech and politics intersect. Hello, Monica.
Hello.
Let's talk about antitrust briefly, because I feel like that's such a fascinating conversation. Like, we wouldn't be having this conversation if the scale were not so great, right? If these companies were not so big and the reach were not so far and two of them didn't control 70 to 80% of the digital ad market. What does that start to look like? Do you think that these conversations about antitrust and breakups are actually, I mean, I know we're in Seattle and this has kind of happened here before, but do you think these are real conversations?
Well, I think the proposal that Senator Warren came out with was intentionally radical, mm-hmm. because there's the sort of the policy objective and then there's the debate objective. And I think more than anything, it's forcing us to have this conversation. But I think there is going to need to be a little bit of a reevaluating of how we think about antitrust. Amazon is a great example. I'm not saying that they are in violation of any antitrust laws, but historically, the way that we've thought about antitrust is big companies using their power to gain a competitive advantage and raise prices. Mm-hmm. Amazon uses their power to gain a competitive advantage and lower prices. Mm-hmm. So how do we define antitrust then under those terms? It's less clear cut. You know, Amazon is also gobbling up huge troves of data. They're not sharing it, they're using it.
Yeah.
And they're using it very effectively. Is that as much of a concern as companies like Facebook that are gathering our data and sharing them with third parties? I don't know, I think it's an important question to ask though.
Right. Giri Srinivas is CEO of Helm, which is a company that, as I understand it, lets you take your information out of someone else's cloud,
yep.
and put it on your own.
That's
and
right.
control it. Tell us what you're doing at Helm.
Yeah, so.
And welcome to the stage.
Thank you, thanks. Yeah, so we have a core belief that individuals should have an easy way to own and control their personal information. And so what we've developed is actually a personal server that goes in your home and starts to replace cloud-based services that you depend on today. So the first thing that we've gotten started with is email. So instead of having your email with a company like Google, for example, you can actually have a Helm personal server in your home on a domain of your choosing, and it works just pretty much like any other email service you'd use today.
I love this because this is like what me and all my nerd friends used to do until we thought, oh, a fire is going to come. We should put our stuff in the cloud. How are we coming back now?
Yeah, well, what's interesting, right, is that you can actually combine, you know, some of the things that the cloud can offer you with some of the, you know, really great innovations that have occurred because of smartphones, interestingly, that have really miniaturized computing to develop a personal server that can go in your home at a pretty decent price, but still have things like, you know, the reliability and continuity of service that you'd expect from the cloud today. So there's a lot of things that have changed, and I'm one of those people. You know, 15 years ago or 16 years ago now, I set up my first email server for myself. And, you know, my co-founder was the same way, and we thought, you know, what we do is actually a labor of love. It takes a lot of time and effort to just do it for yourself. Consumers don't really have an alternative. And even, you know, in your presentation and your conversation earlier, I think one of the things that's missing right now is consumers are looking for alternatives, yeah. Right? They're looking out and they're saying, well, Google provides these services to me, or Facebook provides these services to me. And not just Helm, there are lots of other startups and lots of other companies now that are trying to develop alternatives so that consumers can have more control and can have more ownership, and to fundamentally change the economics around this data economy.
Right. So if we were going to talk about a market-based solution before regulation comes in, can privacy be a selling point?
Well, I think it is. It's already become a selling point. Just today, Apple launched a new advertising campaign around their smartphone, and the number one message for that is around privacy. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a minute-long clip. You can check it out later, but if a company like that is going to put that front and center, and you can argue it's to their benefit, right, to do this because of the way they develop their products, we're now seeing Facebook is making, you know, trying to pivot their entire company around privacy. You could argue that's to head off some of the regulation that's coming their way. But I think it is becoming clear that there is a value that consumers are either having today or going to have in the future for products, and the decisions that they're going to make about the products that they're going to use. So absolutely.
What is the bar become if you promise that privacy? Like, if you're Apple and you're promising privacy as a selling point, but my phone still runs on Verizon,
mm-hmm.
which is gathering information about everywhere I go on my iPhone, you know, yeah. I feel like we're at trust-pocalypse right now when it comes to consumers and companies. And so that even if some parts of this conversation feel unfair to technologists or business people or venture capitalists, that it feels like there's a whole bunch of people who don't care at all, and then there's a whole bunch of people who just aren't going to believe you.
Yeah, I think so. You know, the contrast between what Apple can do for you versus what Verizon doesn't do for you, the danger of that is you go down the slippery slope towards privacy nihilism or security nihilism. And I think it's important that people recognize that they can take steps that matter. And it's going to be a combination of what the market can provide in terms of solutions, but also what the regulatory frameworks can provide. Mm-hmm. I think the combination of those two things are going to drive a healthy environment for consumers to have, you know, their data and have ownership and control and know exactly what's going on. I mean, I think with Cambridge Analytica wouldn't have been as big of a deal as it is now if we didn't have the Snowden revelations back in 2013.
Right.
That is what I think really set the tone for how people are appreciating what's going on with Cambridge Analytica. The Snowden revelations were much more personalized, right? What, you know, the government having access to my data, like, what does that mean for me? Cambridge Analytica showed us that there's an existential threat that comes to our, you know, our very way of life by these huge companies having access to this information in a way that can be manipulated. So it's I think it's a combination of what the regulatory frameworks will do to, you know, kind of paint some boundaries for these companies, but also what the market will offer for these customers.
Yeah, I think that you need both, right? Because you need to have an option for people who are like deeply immersed in these issues and concerned about them, and it's worth paying a premium. But you don't want to create a situation where privacy is just something for those who can afford it. So
yep.
I think the regulatory piece helps with those who are still going to use free services because they cannot, you know, reasonably afford to pay for something. But that doesn't mean that they shouldn't be allowed the same basic rights that we've decided as a society that you should have.
I want to get our next panelist up here immediately because I want to ask him if he thinks that we should outlaw targeted advertising. Ryan Kalo, professor at UW, right around the corner, and co-founder of the Tech Policy Lab. Welcome. Do you think that the solution here to solving this business problem is to outlaw targeted advertising?
Gosh. So I think that if you wind up outlawing targeted advertising, you are essentially outlawing online advertising. The reason being that even today, as we talk about how much advertising is happening online and how much, you know, we are using data in it, Still, the vast majority of ad spend is not online, right? It's still, it's on TV, it's on billboards, it's on this kind of thing, right? The value add of online advertising is the ability to, target very closely. And that's how they go around competing against billboards or against, other kinds of media. Now, whether we should outlaw online advertising is a different question that I have a different answer to. But I think that if you just take away the targeting, the business model doesn't work. Hmm.
I feel like we could have a long conversation about retargeting, but that would just get us down a rabbit hole. What in your view, as somebody who's been working on these issues for a lot of years, what in your view, if anything, has changed since Cambridge Analytica, since those revelations?
Well, I mean, I think that the public awareness, as we've already talked about, has changed substantially since Cambridge Analytica. It's sort of like I've been thinking for a long time, when is privacy going to get its whale song? And what I mean by that is that there were all these fights to combat whaling, and that internationally, and they never really had much traction until somebody all of a sudden dropped a mic very far below and started to record the sperm whale songs. And they played these before the UN. And when you hear these beautiful, eerie, complex whale songs, all of a sudden people go, oh gosh, I get it. We shouldn't be hunting these animals in the way that we're doing, right? What's going to be the thing that gives us traction? Cambridge Analytica and the Snowden revelations, played that role. I'll tell you, having studied privacy for some time now, one of the major, major shifts over the period of time I've been studying it, first in the academy, but now in the mainstream conversation, has been that privacy has shifted from a conversation about whether you have control over your personal information to how you can be controlled by other people that have your personal information. That is a deep, deep shift, and that is precisely, I think, what we're dealing with right now.
What can we do moving forward? We are having this conversation. It feels like the conversation is gaining traction, and I'm sure, I know that there are, I know from conversations with people at these companies that there's this sense that they don't understand what happened. They don't understand why everyone is so angry, and it tells you a lot about what fairness as a concept can do to people, and how upset they can get. But what lessons can we draw from this as we move into, because this extraction shows no sign of letting up, and in fact, huge parts of the digital economy are predicated on it as we move toward artificial intelligence. So, like, now what?
Now what? I mean, it's...
You're a lawyer, man. How come you can't
what?
Help us?
I'm going to solve it. After what I say right now, we can end the panel and then we can move on. So first of all, you had raised, Molly, this provocative idea of, hey, maybe you should get paid for your data, right? And this is something that I've heard, Jared Lanier and many other people have argued for. I'm not a fan of that approach, and I'll explain why. Do you remember like this, I think maybe it's possibly a slightly offensive term, but you remember this idea that like sailors in San Francisco would get like too drunk and then they'd wake up and they'd be on a ship? You know what I mean? They were Shanghai. This idea that, you wake up, all of a sudden you're in the service of this thing. Again, not a great term. But the idea basically is that you wake up in the service of somebody, and those folks, those sailors that woke up on those ships, they were paid. You know what I mean? And if we start paying people for the awful arrangement that they're in, it's a little bit like that in my mind. It's like we all got drunk on data, we woke up, and all of a sudden we're getting a little bit of money for it. You know what I mean? Like, no thank you. So my view is that it's much simpler, right? It's much simpler. The idea is that, you pay for things that are valuable. And I have long been a proponent of the idea of the WhatsApp model before it was purchased, mm-hmm. where you pay a couple dollars a year and you get this service in exchange for it. And yes, there will be people that can't afford it, and we should subsidize it for those people. We should try to keep it affordable, absolutely, right? In fact, maybe even there could be a version of it that is well regulated for people who can't pay anything. But for everybody else, the idea is you pay for stuff. That's the history of the world for hundreds of years. If you want to, some people to do something for you, you pay for it. And so that to me is the radical / extremely simple solution to all of this problem.
Just pay for stuff.
You're listening to a special episode of the GeekWire podcast, and we'll be right back. Welcome back. Let's jump back into our discussion about the data economy, led by Molly Wood.
I think this is a place, though, to point out that the effect has not been that chilling on these companies, right? That Facebook is still reporting that, you know, user growth might be somewhat flat in the United States, but it's growing leaps and bounds all over the country, and that really still a large percentage of people don't care. They sincerely don't care. They don't see it. And so while we're having this conversation in this bubble, how much do we have to consider the possibility that it's not going to go that far?
I would say that people do all kinds of stuff that's bad for them.
Right.
You know?
So we have to help them help themselves.
And we regulate it. You know what I mean? It's just like people do all kinds of stuff that's bad for them.
Yeah.
And on the point about online advertising and targeting, I do want to draw a distinction I think is appropriate, because it's almost excavating a distinction that once was very obvious but has gone away, which is there's a few different ways to target ads online. One of them is just about being contextual. Right? You are reading an article about soccer and you're sold soccer balls. That is a very different thing from following you around and supplementing that data from a third party and getting the data from here and building this psychological profile of you and then serving you the ad that not only is of interest to you, but it's actually served in such a way that it's going to be the most attractive to you. So for example, I've seen research showing that you can have the same ad, but you can couch it differently depending on what you understand about a person's psychology. So for example, let's say that for whatever reason, Monica's like, well, all she cares about is what's popular. You know, she's really, she's just like really into popularity.
Not your vibe, by the way.
Exactly. Not your vibe, which is why it's funny. But it's, the idea is like, you care about what's really popular. And so when you get this advertisement, what you see in the advertisement is it says our most popular item. And you're like, oh, I'll take that. That's our most popular item, right? But for some reason, the way that I grew up, what I really care about is I'm really worried about scarcity. You know what I mean? I just grew up in an environment where I don't care. I buck the system. I don't care what everybody else thinks. But I really worry about scarcity. And that same product is sold to me, and it says, while supplies last. Right? I've seen research suggesting that that's effective. Right? Mm-hmm. So there's a huge delta between just showing your ads because you happen to, I know you like soccer because you watch the soccer, versus this profiling, right? I will say, though, that especially when you get into the political realm, there is a very unfortunate elephant in the room at one level, which is the First Amendment. So if you begin to aggressively assert a prohibition on online advertising, you will get massive pushback under the First Amendment. It'll be like this. Imagine that a person who's running for Congress has a room like this in front of her, and she walks around talking to various people, and she tries to get the sense of what the sentiments are. You know what I mean? And so she just hears from you, and these are your concerns, and blah, blah, blah. And she comes up and sits on up here, and then she tells a story that seems to resonate with the people that she talked to. And you tell her, you can't do that. You can't select your message on the basis of talking to people about what their interests are, right? No way that flies in our system. So what's the distinction between that and following people online and tailoring your message on the basis? That's the kind of argument you're going to get from people who weaponize the First Amendment. So I mean, I think that it's very fraught to try to ban a category of speech, whereas it's much simpler to promote the paid option, which I think actually finally will take off. Mm.
I mean, while we're talking about politics and kind of the global impact of these companies, I think probably most people in the business community would say that the reason that America has all of the biggest, most valuable tech companies is because they're in America, because the climate here has created them. But when you think about them expanding out into the global economy, there's a difference in value between what a middle-class American trades off in terms of their data for what they get from Facebook, and maybe they have the luxury of looking at privacy as more of a concern, than in the developing world where you might be a small business owner and have absolutely no infrastructure to set up your own website or online payment system. And Facebook is offering all of these things, which in that case, maybe privacy feels like a fair trade-off. So as these companies expand out into the world, I mean, on the one hand, you want to think about do we want to create a regulatory environment that discourages the next Google? On the other hand, do we have an opportunity in the US, because we contain all of these companies, to create rules of the road that are really fair in countries where the consumers might not have as much say in advocating for what they really need? Mm-hmm.
Thank you everyone for attending. Thanks to our brilliant panel. How great are they?
That was Molly Wood of American Public Media's Marketplace Tech Report with Giri Srinivas, CEO of private email server startup Helm, Ryan Kahlo, co-director of the University of Washington's Tech Policy Lab, and me, Monica Nicholsberg, GeekWire's Civic Editor, during an event hosted by KUOW on March 14th. Thanks for listening to the GeekWire podcast. Be sure to subscribe, rate, and review GeekWire in your favorite podcast app. We'll be back later this week with our weekly news roundup. Until next time, I'm Monica Nicholsberg. Thanks for listening.